And this is KPCW. You're listening to the Local News Hour. KPCW News Time is 8:06. Well, let's find out what's in store for the weather coming up. Something tells me it's going to be hot. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes with ABC4 Weather.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch. Back on this Friday, we're going to be looking at hazy, smoky skies out there, but lots of sunshine, which means the heat will be building in across the area. Temperatures will be climbing into the lower 90s for us in Park City. We'll see our high temperatures climbing into the upper 90s in the Heber Valley. Again, watch out for some of those hazy, smoky skies, but lots of sunshine as the dangerous heat begins to really take over the area. Now, as we go into your weekend, that's when the core of the dangerous heat moves in. Lots of sunshine. High temperatures will be in the mid-90s for your Saturday in Park City. We're talking highs in the triple digits in the Heber Valley with lots of sunshine. As we move into your Sunday, lots of sunshine expected. Highs back in the mid-90s in Park City. We'll have those high temperatures in the triple digits in the Heber Valley once again. Moving into early next week, we may see a couple of weak fronts move by to our north. That may pick up the wind just a little bit out of the south and west, giving us an increased fire danger threat for us as we go into your Monday and Tuesday. But it may also take just a smidge off of the extreme heat for us. So high temperatures as we head into your Monday, only around 90 in Park City, only in the upper 90s in the Heber Valley. That trend will continue into your Tuesday with mostly sunny skies, highs only around 90 in Park City, with highs in the upper 90s into the Heber Valley. Hopefully you enjoy the brief reprieve, because guess what? As we go into next Tuesday and Wednesday, here comes the heat once again. Especially by Wednesday and Thursday, highs will be back into the low to mid 90s for us in Park City. And we'll see those highs climbing into the upper 90s and triple digits once again in the Heber Valley. So the little break from the heat will just be a couple of degrees, and really only for your Monday and the Tuesday. Otherwise, lots of sunshine, dry conditions as this heat dome takes hold. Be careful out there, folks, this weekend. Take the heat serious. Make sure you remember to check on your elderly friends and neighbors, and also making sure you're keeping an eye on the kids. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with Casey Metzger of Top Shelf Bar Services. Then Jason Glidden of Mountainlands is going to stop by to update us on some goings-on with Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, and we'll finish our hour with a pre-recorded feature by Grace Dorfler on Encircle Closing Day. Stay tuned. Wasatch County's second high school opened to the public on Wednesday. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the new school expands opportunities for students.
Deer Creek High School opened with a ribbon cutting and a shower of blue, silver, and white confetti Wednesday evening. The school was bustling with activity for the first time, with around 300 students, parents, staff, and other community members exploring the grounds. Principal Justin Kelly was excited to see the school filled with community members at last.
That was the fun part to me, is seeing how much of the community showed up, but to see all the kids dressed in navy, silver, and white.
Those are the school's colors, and Deer Creek students participating in cheerleading, student government, band, and other extracurriculars showed them off on their new uniforms. Kelly said navy is for all the blues in the Heber Valley, including the Skies, Emerald Lake in Mount Timpanogos, and Deer Creek Reservoir. Silver is for the nearby silver mines in Midway and Park City, and white is for the snow-capped mountains. Kelly also wore the colors, including custom Nike shoes that say Deer Creek on the back. Superintendent Garrick Peterson said the opening was emotional but satisfying.
All of a sudden you start to hear the stories of kids and experiences that they're having here. Kids having opportunities that they maybe wouldn't have had if we hadn't opened up a second school.
The opening of the school doubles the number of Wasatch County students able to participate in student government, sports, and arts programs. Lily Peary has two daughters who will attend Deer Creek as a junior and senior this fall. They wanted to go to Deer Creek for the sports opportunities.
My junior's been trying out for things. She got to be on the, she just made the soccer team, which is huge, right? That she gets to do that. She wouldn't have before.
Julia Krager's son will also be a junior at Deer Creek this fall. He plans to play lacrosse.
Some of my older kids got lost in their bigger high school at Wasatch, which we loved Wasatch too. But I'm just so happy that we're having smaller crowds.
Peterson said kids also chose their school based on relationships. That's something he noticed after opening schools in Alpine School District, where he previously worked as a principal and director. He said he has one child attending Wasatch and one attending Deer Creek.
It's all about connection. The people that they're already connected to, usually they're friends, but it might be a teacher or a coach, or dreams of a different connection. Do you know what? I'm hoping to go there to maybe connect with people that I don't feel like I've been connected with.
Junior Chloe Gordon decided to attend Deer Creek for a mix of those reasons. She's following friends, her tennis coach, and wanted to participate in student government for the second year in a row. She's also looking forward to writing the first draft of Deer Creek's story.
Not a lot of kids get the opportunity to make their own traditions, and we get the wonderful opportunity to do so and make, you know, the first homecoming at Deer Creek in football games.
Gordon and the rest of Deer Creek's student government have been meeting throughout the summer to get those traditions started. They chose the school's slogan, "Together We Soar," as a play on the Riverhawks mascot. The group also created a motto, "Be the First." It's meant to help students build connections and support one another. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Casey Metzger, the owner of Top Shelf Bar Services, has joined me in the studio to update us on his new EPS service and to tell us what's going on in that world. Good morning, Casey, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Roger.
There we go. Okay, so Casey, Top Shelf's been around for 20 years. What inspired you? What's the career track that led you to Top Shelf, and what did you think it would offer?
I cut my teeth on Main Street as a bartender and working in the restaurant scene and ski bumming, if you will, right? And
in the great tradition of most Park City business leaders.
You know, it's a beautiful way of life. The only thing is when you start having children, it doesn't really go hand in hand. So I really saw a need. I had a clientele, and I left the bar scene and started doing parties at people's homes. And one thing led to another, and I got to a point where I was like, hey, I think the community likes to have someone come to their home, or the wedding scene was starting to grow. And as this town has grown, it's really grew demand where Top Shelf could lean in and help, and we're a destination events community. And so that's what we do. We kind of cater to
that. Well, let's explain that. What is the typical engagement? What does Top Shelf bring to the party, literally?
We are, it's a mobile bar service that is very specialized. It's a catering service, right, that is specialized in the bartending services of itself. So I don't know food. I don't do food. I love food. Big fan of the fork, but what I know is drinks and mixology and really hospitality. That's what we pride ourselves on bringing hospitality, great people to help entertain. And our tagline is helping clients with execute fun, safe, and memorable events. So that could be, that shows up in a number of different ways. That could be private, intimate gatherings of, you know, 20, 30 people. It could be weddings, destination weddings, and we're a huge destination for incentive travel. So we work with a lot of the destination management groups and hotels to cater to events that they do around town. This town and the events looks a lot different now than it did 20 years ago.
So let's talk about sort of the range of services you might offer. I would guess that there is, in terms of a bar setup, or there's a whole range that from a somewhat narrow set of categories to people who want more exotic and interesting drinks. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so basically, if you want drinks, we will travel. So we've done a series of things. We've done educational things, so mixology classes. We've done, in COVID, we did the bartender's box where it was a pivot project, and we love to craft ingredients, put it in a box and deliver it to your doorstep, right? That was kind of a desperate measure, but it was a really creative time for us and, something we're proud of. But it's, you know, we tend to say, you know, if you need bartending services, whether you're, you know, on the top of a mountain or at a church or at a festival fair, you know, we'll be at the Arts Festival next weekend, so we'll be helping with the Kimball Arts Festival, and we'll do services for those guys, and we'll do rodeos and all those sorts of things.
Now, one of the things I've noticed in recent years is when you go to one of these events, quite often there is a signature cocktail that is offered. Do you develop those, and how much fun is that?
It's probably the most fun, besides being out there and giving service. I love people, and I love making people drinks and making people smile. It's a, it's always a fun place to be. People are really happy to see you. I don't sure that every profession everybody wants to see a lawyer. No offense, Roger.
Yeah, I was a lawyer, and people never wanted to see me again.
But so people love to see it, and I love making the cocktails. That's the creative part that is really fun, and we have an amazing team of mixologists, and it serves a purpose at events. Mm-hmm. So when you see that, the reason, you know, the methodology or the reason why we love doing that is that you can move a lot of cocktails, or excuse me, you can get drinks in people's hands really fast. So you make them in batch, and that's what we do. We batch them out. We have a craft feel, but we can throw it over the bar real quick, pass them out, and everybody's happy, because who wants to stand in the line, right? When's the last time you went to an event and you were like 47th in line and you're just like, man, it's hot and I'm thirsty?
That's really interesting. I guess from a consumer's perspective, you think, oh, that's creative. It's interesting. They've got something special, and really focused on the fact that what it enables you to do, that on the other side of the bar, it's also facilitating speed.
It's facilitating speed, and we're social lubricators, I think, and so we like to come up with names and have our clients come up with fun names. So, you know, if you know somebody, you have a little icebreaker in your hand and they can come and name it after their dog or their college mascot or something like that at a wedding, right? Where drinks bring people together. And it's really, you know, the people that make a really great occasion, right? And so we're in the background trying to help that facilitate.
So I take it that your expertise really flows along at least two fronts. One is, how do I make the drinks? How do I get the stuff there? And the other is the infamous Utah legal regulatory structure, that you've got to understand how this works, and it's complicated. Talk to us a little bit about what it takes. What do you have to do to be able to serve alcohol at a private event?
It takes a long minute, I'll tell you that. It takes a long minute to figure out exactly how to do that. You know, we get a bad rap in Utah about weird liquor laws, and they're certainly cumbersome. Where there's a will, there's a way. And around the country, they're just as awkward sometimes, right? So, but essentially, there's a series of different licenses. Over the years, the state has created more and more for different situations as we've evolved, right? As the demographics change and occasions change and creative entrepreneurs and whatnot and events pop up, they got to make a new law. They got to make a new clause. They got to make so. There's a lot of layers. There's restaurant liquor licenses. There's bar liquor licenses. Special event liquor licenses. Hotels, lounges. I mean, there's one for many occasion, right? So, and it's very hard to interpret. And I think that's the key is that, you know, if you have a private club, you've got to really understand the business that you're in, and then overlay a license that will work for it, right?
So let's take, I'm having a wedding reception. I've rented a park, and I want you to come and serve the liquor. What kind of a license? Do you have to get that license? What is the license that has to be put into play for something like that?
So, Roger, the first thing we do is we say, tell us your vision. Mm-hmm. What are you doing, really? And so, depending on what you're actually doing at the park, mm-hmm. we'll decide whether you need a certain license to do so. So essentially, it's really pretty simple, but the differentiation between a private event where you don't have to have a license.
You don't have to have a license for a private event.
Okay. And a open to the public event where you need to have a license. And there's a fine line there. And really, the easy way to think about it, and if you were to call the state, this is what they say. A private event, think of it like a wedding. A private event, if you know everybody that's coming and you have a guest list and you're going to buy the wine, you can invite as many guests as you'd like, but you can't sell tickets to it. You can't have a monetary value associated with anything that you're giving them. And if you sell a ticket, so there's a monetary gain there, you need to have a license. And if it's open to the public, and you're given away, you have to have a license. So it's situational, and sometimes it gets a little bit foggy to understand.
So something like the Arts Fest, where there's going to be people, you know, public attendance, will that have a special, a single event, if you will, license? Is that how that works?
Yes, sir. They ultimately, the goal is to have a license with the state.
Okay.
You have to have a Department of Alcohol and Beverage Service license. And in order to do that, they can sell drinks. Mm-hmm. Right, and so we're partners with the Arts Festival, And the goal is that we're trying to raise as much money to help them, right? So they have to get a license. We come in and just as a logistics company and a bartending service to help them. But they had to get a license from the state, which has licenses from the local compliance that they need to get. And then within that permit, as a lawyer, you'd appreciate this. There's lots of paperwork, right?
Somehow I thought that might be the case.
Do this before you do that.
Yeah.
Talk this, don't say this, always say this. And you have to have a really understanding of the industry to do it. And so that's where we can kind of help.
And while they get the license, I take it that you can help people who haven't done this before, help them walk through the process.
100%. We've been pulling these licenses and helping people for, 18 plus years. And what the state will give license, the biggest thing is that to get a license, you could have an art gallery and go out and get a single event license, right? But you don't know the industry. Mm-hmm. And it's scary and it's difficult and it's, you don't know the process and the method and really, do you have the coverage and all that sort of stuff. So they'll give them to anybody that has a license or business license for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a matter of like, how do I navigate this? And how do I have a peace of mind? And how do I do it right? So I don't put anybody in jeopardy, I don't risk anything, and I'm compliant.
And that's kind of a segue into EPS.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about, why did you decide to launch EPS as its own service, and what does it do?
So EPS it's called Event Permitting Solutions. It's just a bolt-on service that we're doing, and we've done this for a long time. And what we've seen and the reason, and what it does is we have three or four different solutions that we can help someone pull these permits. This town and this state is very philanthropic in nature, and there's a lot of different organizations. Per capita, .org is like a big thing in Utah, right? And they, in that example, when they have galas or when these nonprofit organizations want to throw an event, they're raising money and at dinners and stuff, right? And so they need to have these licenses. For years, we would help people get these licenses and interpretate how to do it, right? It's just getting more and more and bigger and bigger. There's just a lot of different events, and everybody who's been around here for a while can see that. And so we saw a need, and I've talked to people that went through this process and in tears because they don't know how to do it, and they're like, why do they have to have the fireman come to my house? why would I have a $2 million insurance policy for this, or I don't have workman's comp, what do I do there? So we just saw a need, and it was a pain point. Nonprofits are what helped my business get started back in 2008. And when I say that, we did a lot of nonprofit stuff, and that's how I met people. That's how I got out in the community. I see a need, and I see a pain point, and I've had so many of our clients say, God, thank you so much for doing this for me.
So when you say it's a bolt-on, what you're saying is if someone's going to use your services to provide the liquor, the bar service, they can also sort of engage you as a parallel to help them walk through this process.
100%. We can do it as part of an event that we're helping them with. We can do it as a consultant on the side. If it's a small event, we'll do the math, right? And we'll pencil that through a pro forma. We'll say, how about we just do the permit for you, and then we'll meet you on site, and we'll get you started.
Right.
And if you need to rent a trash can, we'll give you one of those steps. But
it may not make sense for them to bring in entire bar service.
Yeah, because they could use volunteers. But if as that scale goes big, like this weekend we did one for, 5,000 people, and that's a little bit daunting for people to do a pop up for 5,000 people, and that's our bread and butter. That's in our zone.
5,000 people. So this makes me believe that you have to have this very large network of people you could call on when you need them.
Yeah. We have 70 employees.
Right.
That a roster of 50 to 60, and they're school teachers, they're entrepreneurs, they're students. There's a ton of people that we can lean into, and it taps into that gig economy. You know what I mean?
And I imagine a lot of them like to do that because it's in the evening and they've been able to ski all day first, right?
Yeah, it's kind of fun going out and making money instead of spending money these days, I'll tell you that.
Okay, before we go, what do you see a common mistake that people make when they're trying to put one of these things together that gets them into some trouble?
Yeah, I don't necessarily see them, because if I see them, I'll help you get in
right,
there.
Exactly.
But what happens is it's timelines. It's not doing things in the right way. And here's the thing. The state and the cities, they'll give these permits to just about anybody as long as they have the qualifications as far as their LLCs and whatnot. But it's the compliance measures that are really come down to safety. They come down, and that's where, you know, if someone got one of these permits because they're doing the right thing, but they just don't understand the industry, and they're not trained, and they don't know that hospitality space, and that's where it can get a little sloppy. Yeah. And there's a lot riding on them doing it right, because if they do it wrong, they get fined and those sorts of things. So without saying specifics, it's just knowing how to do it and being in the right place and knowing how to guide people and keep it safe. It's all about safety, I guess, right?
Yeah. Okay, Casey, anything else you want to touch on before we go? How can people get a hold of you if they're interested?
They're interested for any entertaining, like, for that matter, it's topshelfutah.com. And on our page, you could find the EPS, the Event Permitting Solutions. And thanks, Park City.
All right. We've been speaking with Casey Metzger of Top Shelf Bar Services. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Appreciate it, Roger.
We'll be right back after this. Summit County Not-for-Profit is hosting a series of arts and culture events this summer. KPCW's Ula Britt Libre reports on the group's effort to spark creativity in the Wasatch Back.
The Arts Council of Park City and Summit County invites the community to an array of events this summer, ranging from art shows to a monster drawing rally. The nonprofit aims to enhance culture and creativity across the Wasatch Back. Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder encourages residents of all ages to submit artwork for display at the Summit County Fair in August.
Any type of art is accepted, and it's an opportunity to kind of get involved with the fair scene, which is really, really fun. You can win ribbons, premiums, but really it's just fun to kind of show off your talent and connect and bring your friends to see your artwork.
Artists can drop off their work August 4th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Ledges Event Center in Colville. The exhibit runs August 6th through 8th at the County Fairgrounds. Participants can compete for ribbons and cash prizes. The Arts Council will also purchase artwork for permanent display at the Colville Courthouse. On August 22nd, Arts on the Trail offers live performances and visual art along a 1.5-mile accessible route near the Copper Moose Farm Stand in Park City. Scudder says the event started in 2018 to bring art into a setting where visitors may not expect to find it.
We found that people really love that intersection between immersing in nature and getting outside, going for a lovely walk, and then also happening upon a really unique performance.
This year's lineup includes the Indigenous-led dance group Cultural Fire Events and pop-up performances from the Ryrie Dance Company. Tickets are $25. In September, the nonprofit hosts its annual Monster Drawing Rally at the Kimball Arts Center. Artists create 2D art pieces live in 50-minute shifts. The art is then immediately available for $50 each. Creators must apply by August 20th. Complete details and tickets are available at kpcw.org. The Arts Council of Park City and Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Ula Britt Libre, KPCW News.
Mountainlands Community Housing is about to cut the ribbon on a new project in Heber City. Here to tell us about Parkview Place is Executive Director Jason Glidden. Good morning, Jason. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Roger. Good morning.
So, Jason, let's start with the basics. What is Parkview Place, and how long has it been under development?
Yeah, so Parkview Place is a 49-lot subdivision that Mountainlands purchased in 2017 off of Southfield Road in Heber, so kind of close to the fairgrounds there. So we started in 2017 and really started to put the infrastructure in, the roads and sewers and utilities and such, and then began building some single-family homes there. We've progressed. We're in, obviously, you know, we're 9 years into this now, but it just takes time, right? And so we've moved on now where we're building townhomes down there. And like you said, we're getting ready to cut the ribbon on 6 new townhomes that we utilized our mutual self-help program. This is very similar to kind of what Habitat does, where participants come in and they actually build their homes. And what makes that program special is the fact that they get to be on site and help to learn how to build their homes, participate in building their homes. And it's a commitment. We started these 6 homes about 8 months ago.
That's fast.
Well, you know, I know it wasn't a great ski season, but it was a great construction season. So normally it takes about a year for us to get these done. And these folks have to commit to 30 hours a week, and 15 of it has to be done by them specifically, and then the other 15 can be actually done by volunteer. So they can bring other volunteers in to help with to meet that 30 hours. So, I mean, that's it, like I said, it's a large commitment, 30 hours a week. It's another job. But the folks are, you know, that we do have, the participants we've had are just so gracious and excited for the home, and they're excited to learn more about how to build a home, and it really gave them a lot of background on how to maintain their home because they actually built it. So we see a lot of value in that. I think the other really positive thing about this program is really how the funding comes together, and it's a program through the USDA, Rural Development, and we use a program or a loan product called a 502 Direct Loan. And this loan is special because of a couple things. First off, it is a loan that starts as a construction loan. And then once we get to a certification of occupancy, C of O, then it turns into a permanent
mortgage.
And so that's a little bit different than most people just go right to a direct mortgage. So this allows for the construction loan that goes directly into a permanent loan. The second is that these are offered because we are building for, I would say, lower income folks, that they can get a special interest rate. And it really depends on their income. And that would range from anywhere from 1% to 5%, where most of our folks are getting a 1% or 2% interest rate. So, and the terms of it can go out to 38 years. So when you couple, the terms going out longer, your lower interest rate, it really allows these folks to be able to handle that monthly payment to afford the mortgage.
So ultimately, these people will be, full owners with a mortgage. What were the income requirements in order to qualify to be able to get one of these homes?
Yeah, so the USDA requires that they have to be under 80% of the area median income. So we usually target folks. There's a couple things that we look for as far as good candidates. Mm-hmm. Obvious, and it's very similar to what banks would look for as well, right? We're looking at your credit score. Yep. Yeah. We're looking at your income to make sure you're going to income qualify. And then last is we're going to look at your debt to income. Mm-hmm. How much debt do you have, that you have to take care of every month, and could you afford an additional payment onto that? So those are the three big things that we look for. As far as income-wise, we usually target that 75% AMI. That makes us feel a little bit better and where we need to be. And we have to update that throughout the process. So we have to actually do, the USDA will ask us to resend these income qualifications throughout the process.
So when an individual qualifies, given this is a construction loan, I take it that they will basically be assigned that, they are assigned that property, or they are on the hook for that property during the construction process.
So when the loan closes for the construction portion of it, they actually are purchasing the property.
They're purchasing the property from
Mountainlands. That's
you.
Correct.
Right. Yep. Okay.
And then they act actually as the general contractor, right?
Right.
And Mountainlands' role is actually of technical assistance. So we do have a construction supervisor on there who does take care of all the subcontractors that we do have to hire, because there are things that
I don't think they can be doing all that electrically themselves.
Yeah. So the program requires that they have to build 65% of the home. So things like the electrical, some of the plumbing, and some of those specialty items, we do bring in subcontractors, and our construction supervisor organizes all that.
So he assists the homeowner who probably doesn't have all the background in going out and hiring somebody and moreover in managing them.
That's correct. And then we also take care of the accounting of it. So in-house. Now they do receive updates. They have to sign off on every invoice. So they see every single invoice. They have to sign every contract with every subcontractor. And then we send them budget updates to show where that we're at in the budget. So they are very much a part of it. I think provides that additional education on the difficulties of building a home.
Was there a lot of competition to try to get access to these, and is there a lot of competition?
I'd say there is. There's a lot of people that want to participate.
Exactly.
It's whether or not you can actually qualify that really makes it difficult. And, I think we've found that it's a great program for a lot of the workforce. We do have a lot more, I would say, smaller families or new families that are coming into the community or working in the community and want to come into the community and live in the community. So they definitely, we've had right now a lot of firefighters are coming in, which is great. This current group that we have that are building right now, we have some employees from Deer Valley. We've got one from IHC. I'm trying to think of any others. I mean, but we are really doing a good job of gaining a lot of these employees that are actually critical in this community.
So at the beginning, you told, I believe you said it was a 48 lot,
the 49 lot
49
subdivision.
Lots. Yep. So how far along are you, and what comes next?
Yeah, so I'm really glad you asked that. So because this, with the self-help program, like I said, we're cutting the ribbon on these six. We'll be breaking ground next month on our next six, and we're in the process of looking for the next six. And these
the
will be
applicants for the next
applicants
six.
For the next six. And these will be right now the last six for the self-help that we'll be doing in the Heber area. And it's just the way the pipeline works, you know. So we encourage folks, if you're, you know, you're interested in living in that area, this could be your last shot for a little bit in building. So, you know, to reach out to us. As far as the overall 49 sub lot division, I think after these six are completed, we'll have 18 left. And then you have the two groups of six that we'll be doing with self-help. So that'll be 12. We have four single family lots that we're working on right now and figuring out what we're going to do with those.
Yeah, how would those work?
Well, I mean, they could work a number of ways. I mean, we could, you know, Mountainlands could just go ahead and build them and then sell them. There's a lot of risk to us with doing that, yeah. And a lot of capital you have to find to do that. We're looking at some different partnerships with some other organizations. We have had a partnership with that in that subdivision with the Wasatch School District, mm-hmm. Where we sold them lots, and the students come in and build the homes and then resell them back to school district employees. I would love to see that continue, and so we're in talks with them a little bit about that and how we can help continue that, because I think not only is it helping to support critical employees with the school district, it's really promoting the trades, which is, you know, definitely something that we want to help with, because, you know, they have seen a drop in the number of people that are going into the trades.
Okay, so that's how that project will get fleshed out. Just I want to stop and let you make your public ad, which is, if people are interested in applying, how do they sort of come forward? How do they reach you?
Yeah, so I would say that what the best thing to do is to go on our website, which is housinghelp.org. There is a link right there as far as self-help and your interest, and you'll be connected with Meredith in our office, who helps and handles all those applications. And I think best to reach out to her and schedule a time to come in and just chat with her a little bit, and so she can understand your situation and figure out if you're going to be a good applicant or what you can do to prepare to be a good applicant. That's one thing that we do work on. We have folks that have come in, and at that time, you know, due to whatever reasons, you know, they're not ready, right? Mm-hmm. But we'll start working with them and saying, hey, here are the four or five steps that you need to do to become a better applicant.
And just so people get a sense of how do you get here? Obviously, you bought 9 years ago, mm-hmm. a plot of land. How is that financed? How do you sort of get, how do you get projects like this going?
Yeah, a variety of ways. I would say with this project, it was a little different that we actually took out a traditional loan for that property. It's not the way we'd prefer to do it, obviously, because there's what we call carrying costs, right?
Right.
You know, the insurance and everything, and then interest rates you have to pay for and everything like that. So in other situations, Silver Creek area, we did self-help homes there. And, you know, we were fortunate there where we actually had lots donate to us.
Yeah.
That's the best way for us,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But if not, then, you know, we will look at opportunities where we could do a purchase if need be. We've also looked at the community land trust model, and we've used that before. And to explain a little bit about that really quickly is, you know, the community land trust model is that you have the land, you know, it's either purchased through us, like I said, or it's donated. But when the owner comes in, they're only purchasing the home itself. They're not purchasing the land. And then what they do is they pay a monthly lease fee on that land. And so what it does is takes the land cost out of the purchase price, which allows for the price of the actual home to come down. And so that's a model that's actually becoming very, very popular in the state of Utah. And I think that we're going to start to see it a lot more.
I'm thinking through the math on that. So they're having to pay a land lease. Does that work out from a monthly payment perspective to be less than if they had actually owned the land? Otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
100%.
Am I thinking about it right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, land costs generally, you know, can, you know, be 20 to 25% of the actual purchase cost, right? So,
and lease costs are a lot less than that.
And the lease is very cheap. Yeah, a lot of our land leases right now range from anywhere from about $50 to $100 a month. So comparatively, even with that going into a mortgage is actually going to be less expensive than what they would pay if they had to pay for the home itself.
And from your perspective, that's going to work best if you've gotten the land donated.
Otherwise, obviously, that's the best way. Because we obviously, if we bought it, then...
It's hard to do a $50 lease if you're paying a mortgage that's, you know, costing a lot more than
that's correct.
So what else do you have in the pipeline that for, you know, future projects?
Yeah. We obviously we're partnering with Columbus Pacific and Habitat with the Klein Dolly parcel out by Jeremy Ranch Elementary. We're still in communication or talks with the county right now. And I know there's some movement happening as far as some new zoning that they're looking at, not only for this project, but more to help support affordable housing in the county, which we're really excited about. And so hopefully we'll have some more news there in the next couple of weeks. And then obviously the big one that we're working on is HOPA, you know.
Let's take a step back. Remind people what HOPA is, what the history is, and where we are now.
Sure. So HOPA actually is an acronym for Holiday Village and Parkside Apartments. And those are two properties that Mountainlands has owned
For a long time.
Yeah, since 2002, actually, is I believe 2000 or 2002. I can't remember. But there's 122 units there. And but those buildings were built in 1978-79. So as you can imagine, they're nearing the end of their life cycle, or usable life cycle, I would say. And so, you know, we saw an opportunity there to renovate those, to bring them to be able to serve our current residents a lot better. You know, they're not very ADA compliant. You know, we're dealing with a lot of, you know, maintenance issues and stuff that we have to keep up with, which is expensive. So, and also, it's, you know, it's, I would say that we can get more units there, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's underdeveloped a little bit, so.
Okay, so where does that stand? I understand that those are rental units?
Those are rental units, yeah.
And you want to redevelop them, which is a big, expensive project.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that's going to work is if you can get the right kind of financing. Where does that process stand?
Yeah, so, you know, as most of the community is aware, you know, we've been working on this project for a while, and I know it's been, I'm going to say frustrating, but, you know, people are like, well, where are you at? So, I mean, quick history of the update and how this works, you know, is that we need to get low-income tax credits to make this work.
And the acronym they use for that, that's LIHTC?
LIHTC.
Okay.
Yeah, LIHTC. And so, and there's two different types of LIHTC. There's 9% and 4%. We won't get into the differences of that right now, but, you know, really those credits, you get awarded those credits, which you then sell those credits to investors, and those investors, you know, pay you for those, and then you use that for construction. So it actually takes down the amount of actual debt that you have to take on. And by doing that, by not having as much debt to pay for, you can actually charge less rent. And that's the general idea behind low-income tax credits. It's a competitive process.
Mm-hmm.
And in the state of Utah, it's very competitive. You know, so we've applied multiple years and not received the funding. And I'd say the main reason for that is it's expensive to build up here, more expensive than maybe some other areas. And one of the criteria they look at is your cost efficiency. And so we've not scored well on that portion of it. And so what we really wanted to do is take a look at that. We really took it after we didn't receive the funding again. We said we really need to rethink this. And how can we work to make this a better application moving forward? And one thing that we really saw was with our design, you know, we had, you know, it was completely parked underground. And that's expensive. And so now what we're looking at is how do we can redesign that to take away some of those parking costs? And that's where I think we're heading right now. We have a team that we've brought on, Penrose Development. They're a national firm that's coming on to help us with some of this. And, you know, we're really kind of, we've been working on it for quite a few months now, but we're at a point now where we're getting close to maybe having an idea of what we might be doing.
Okay. Jason, I hope we hear results from that sometime soon.
Great.
Appreciate your spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Roger.
Encircle opened its doors in downtown Heber in June 2023. The nonprofit was founded to support LGBTQ kids and their families, and it has four other homes across the state in Provo, Ogden, Salt Lake City, and St. George. Leaders announced in early July that while need exists in Wasatch County, they're closing the home because of low attendance. I spoke with parents, volunteers, and guests about their experiences with Encircle over the past several years. Each conversation has been edited for time and clarity. Colleen Potter was Heber City's mayor when Encircle announced plans for the home in 2020. She also raised two LGBTQ children, both of whom were grown by the time Encircle came to the Heber Valley.
It was around the time I had approved the Pride banners for Main Street. We had that request, and I'd approved that, and I was friends with Stephanie Larson, the founder of Encircle, and we would talk about it, and and she was really caring and concerned about our community and the needs that we had. And so she started working on it. And I was thrilled, of course, but thinking, oh, wow, that would have been such a gift for us if we had had that when they were younger, especially my oldest. There was just nothing. No one was talking about LGBT issues. We didn't know anybody. And I was just over the moon excited about it, just knowing I'd known too many kids who struggled. I'd been to too many funerals and just knew that we needed some support and help in this valley for these sweet kids who didn't have the acceptance and, you know, people didn't have the understanding to know how to help them.
Research from the Trevor Project, an LGBTQ suicide prevention organization, shows over 40% of young queer Utahns seriously considered suicide in 2024. About half of those surveyed said home was an affirming space. In 2019, while Potter was mayor, Heber City flew rainbow banners on Main Street. But after condemnation from some community members, the city council changed its policy.
I'm not in elected office and not as involved the way I used to be. But I have been surprised over the years at the number of people who have come to me and said how grateful they were for those banners, how grateful they've been for Encircle, for conversations that started happening in our community. People who said, oh, wow, before that, I didn't know anything, and now I've learned, or maybe one of their kids came out later, or one of their family members or friends. And I feel like a lot more people have more compassion and understanding around this issue than they did at least when I started dealing with it about 15 years ago. We have taken a couple steps backward, I feel like, politically. I know that's sort of how the world works, but it feels like, particularly for transgender kids, it's become somewhat more difficult and politicized than it even was when my daughter came out 10 years ago. I'm really sad to hear that they aren't staying open. You know that lives are being saved. I believe that. I believe that kids that have a safe place, and the data shows it, if they have a safe place where they are accepted and they have people around them that understand them and it gives them more hope and forward thinking about the possibility of living a happy, healthy life. There's pictures on the walls of, you know, queer people who have been successful, and they can look up and see Elton John and Harvey Milk and so many others. And it just has a special feeling there. I believe that it saves lives. And I also know that there are a lot of realities that when you're running a nonprofit, that it can be challenging to do everything that you want to do in every community you would love to do it in.
Cherry Jones is a longtime volunteer at Encircle Heber. He says LGBTQ kids in Heber need support beyond what the high school's Gay Straight Alliance, or GSA, can provide.
I've been volunteering for like 3 years. I'm always there to listen to them, do activities with them, get to know them, and just kind of like hear their stories. These kids are being bullied. They get called slurs. These kiddos like literally don't even have a safe space. Like, yeah, the GSA exists, but that's only during the school year and only when it's like club meeting time, while what they really need is a safe space to go, like throughout the day or like after school. So we are kind of working on making a community center. That is the end goal, to have a safe space for the youth and young adults to go to. We just care a lot about these youth, and they deserve way better than what they were given.
Jackson Persh is another longtime volunteer. He says Encircle provided a much needed space for young people in the valley to relax and meet new people, whether they're queer or not.
Out of everyone I've worked with in this area, Encircle definitely has been the most accommodating and most like understanding of me as a person, which is surprising since I'm not even part of the queer community, but it's been nothing but a good time. The Heber Valley has like no community things that are outside of the churches from what I've seen, but it's just nice being able to know you can just drop in at any time at this location and know you might be able to find somebody to hang out with. One thing that I found interesting talking with some of the higher-ups at Encircle was that they said, we're not here to change minds. We're just here to create, like, an accepting space. And when they explained their reasoning, it was kind of a thing of they wanted to make Encircle a place of, like, no sides, only love. But then at the same time, when it comes to moving into new territory, like how Encircle was moving into Heber, I feel like the No Size Only Love suddenly does start to become kind of an obstacle by trying to be entirely accepting, not have any side. It made it harder and more uncomfortable to push in and actually spread awareness. The queer community exists and is much closer than people in Heber realize. I think a lot of people in this community just kind of go through life thinking that people who are outside of the cultural norm just don't really exist. And I think that's what makes it so there's like the people who are aware, they either are incredibly accepting or are, for lack of a better term, completely insane when it comes to their reaction, because it's just so foreign to a lot of people here. They think, oh, that's a city thing. That's not a rural thing.
When Jim Judd's youngest child came out in middle school, the family made the drive to Encircle Provo at least once a week. The Judds were involved in the Heber home from the time it was announced.
The whole idea behind the Encircle program was just such a life-saving, game-changing event for our kids. You know, particularly my youngest. Just, you know, life is complex for a kid navigating the LGBT world, and there's not a lot of places. School can be tough, church can be tough, neighborhoods can be tough, and the Encircle home is just this place, a gathering place. I think one of the things that a program like Encircle does is it puts this kind of beacon on a hill of, we're here, this is a safe place. And then as that hill lights, people come out of the woodwork that you would never have known were there. You know, take for example, like in church, you wouldn't naturally go to church advertising out, you know, we're LGBT or we're an ally or we believe deeply in this. There's not a venue for that to happen naturally in church, but all of a sudden you can go to an Encircle event and it's like, oh, there's my neighbor down the street, or there's this person in my local congregation. I feel like I've become a better human being by having a queer kid, because it's made me just interact with people at a different level. And I feel blessed and fortunate that I've been able to raise my kids and having these experiences. And part of that is just finding this community. I couldn't imagine our journey without Encircle. And to hear that that no longer will be a place for kids and families, it's devastating. It really is heartbreaking.
One of Jim Judd's children, Janessa Judd, is working to fill the gap that the home's closure will leave. They say Encircle has been a critical resource for them and their brother.
I am not exaggerating when I say every kid that has been to Encircle, it has changed their life. I mean, truthfully, it was like the first place that I personally went to where I truly felt safe and accepted and unconditional care from these people. And like, I didn't have to hide parts of myself or filter parts of myself. From my experience versus watching my brother's experience, he has had it a lot worse than me. He was uninvited from attending church. Our home and his car have been the target of hate crimes in the past. The bullying at school is just atrocious. Like, he'll come to me every day just like saying what happened that day, whether it's a kid like yelling slurs at them or threatening, or like in the parking lot, like swerving their cars to like, I don't know if they're actually trying or just pretending, but like to hit them. It's pretty rough for all of them.
Janessa Judd launched a fundraiser in response to Encircle closing. They want to be sure queer kids have community and support after the home goes away.
Our end goal is to buy the house, but also knowing that that's not something that can be achieved like right away, we still want to make sure the kids have something to go to. So we're also exploring the idea of doing like meetups throughout the community and already existing places while we continue to fundraise and work towards getting the house or just a house in general. I want the kids to know that even if that space is gone, they still have people that they can rely on. I was born and raised in Heber City, and that's something that I'm proud of. And I'm also queer, and I'm proud of that. And those two are not, should not have to be conflicting. I know for a lot of kids right now it is, because the community they're in doesn't accept them. And so I really just want to build a place where they know there are people in the community that accept them. That's my end goal.
Encircle Heber is hosting a goodbye gathering Friday evening. Meanwhile, Janessa Judd and their friends are continuing to raise money to create a new safe space for LGBTQ young people in the community. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Coming up Monday on Mountain Money, Kevin Kennedy and I will be talking to a guy named Michael Pollack. He's got a book called Sidewalk Nation, The Life and the Law of America's Most Overlooked Resource. I hadn't really thought much about sidewalks until I read this book. The interview should be fascinating. Please join us Monday morning at 9 for Mountain Money, only here on KPCW.